Hi, friends. Welcome back to another episode of Peer Connections, the podcast series brought to you by the Global Peer Financing Association, also known as GPFA. These podcasts offer our GPFA members and global beneficial owner friends a forum for information sharing and discussion on topics most important to them. And we hope you, our listeners, appreciate the insights, best practices, and transparency offered from our members and industry friends about securities, finance, or related investment areas. Now let's get into the episode.
All right, listeners. Well, it's been a moment since the GPFA, Global Peer Financing Association podcast, Peer Connections, has graced your listening channels. But we're back, and we're back in a pretty exciting way because we're back in partnership with the team from ISLA, which is the International Securities Lending Association, in advance of their upcoming annual conference in June in Madrid this year. I am one of your hosts today, Brooke Gilman, and I have back with me one of the core GPFA members, Mr. Matt Brunette from Norges Bank. Matt, how you doing?
Good, thank you.
Good.
Happy to be back.
Good. I keep hoping we're going to do more and more of these, hopefully, to pick it up for Peer Connections, Matt. So Matt and I have been trying to lead an effort to both bring greater education to the peer community within GPFA, but in particular ahead of an upcoming industry conference, which is ISLA's Global Securities Finance and Collateral Management Conference in Madrid, Spain, in which the dates are June 17th to 19th. So coming up in the days and weeks ahead, we look forward to hopefully seeing as many beneficial owners in attendance there for that conference. And so in advance of that, Matt took a good look at the agenda, both understanding the focus of that conference, but also in your role, Matt, as a board member for ISLA, to better understand and think through what topics might be useful to do a bit of a deeper dive or a bit of an intro to ahead of the conference for beneficial owners. And so with that, one of the topics we identified was digital assets. And conveniently and luckily, ISLA has a lot of expertise in that space. We have an expert today, thankfully, in the digital asset space that sits on the ISLA board. And that's Matthew McDermott from Goldman Sachs. Matthew, how you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks. Thank you for having me.
Good, good. And so, Matthew, I think it's very interesting. I know that you have, sounds like a long history in the securities finance space, but with your title being the global head of digital assets at Goldman Sachs, sitting on the ISLA board, I think it's an interesting area of focus for the association and for securities finance in general. Maybe can you just give me a sense of your background and role at Goldman and your connection back to securities finance and sort of how both maybe you see digital assets strategically within your bank, but also that area of focus for ISLA?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been at Goldman a long time, actually. I've been there since late 2005, and I've done a number of different jobs within the organization. But kind of post the financial crisis, I started to kind of lean into teams that were focused on financing both the firms and client assets, which was a broad cross-section of different asset classes. And as things meandered, the latter position I held was running globally a team called Cross Asset Financing. And as is the way at Goldman Sachs, you know, you're always looking to kind of keep yourself at the front of the game. And so in 2017-18, this emergence of blockchain technology came to the fore, and the foundations of which really did lend themselves to really improving the efficiency in and around how we could finance across the market, be that repo, securities finance, and other means, be that loans. And so I started to take a kind of keen interest in it then. And then towards the end of 2019, I was asked by a number of different people within the organization to take over what was a very fledgling business called Digital Assets. And for me, the real catalyst to join that business or really develop the business was to see how we could transform the financing markets. And so you kind of roll on 5 years and we're here today and you know, have a team of about 70 people and we do a whole slew of different things across that business. But, you know, still at the core of that is using the distributed ledger technology to think about how we can more efficiently transact.
Perfect person to help us figure out how to translate this then to the beneficial owner community. Because Matt Brunette, I think that, you know, the conversation you and I had, which is that this is such a big area of focus and oftentimes a much discussed topic at industry conferences, but often people probably fall into one of two camps. They either know a lot lot about it and really understand the nomenclature and what people are talking about and how to translate use cases and things, or they're a novice and they know very little and maybe get lost in the weeds of the terminology. So we talked in advance of this, of bringing Matthew onto this podcast, of how do we begin that translation process and maybe start with a little bit more of the basics and work our way up from there. Do you maybe want to kick us off, Matt, seeking some background that you think would be a helpful starting place?
Yeah, sure. So I would definitely put myself in the latter category there, but I'm very interested in technology in general. I always kind of beat the drum that securities finance seems to be the last place that investors want to spend money on upgrading their technology. So any new stuff always seems like a pretty good idea to at least get discussions going about where our priorities should be. We did quite a lot of work on blockchain, I want to say 7 or 8 years ago. So maybe Matt's going to tell us we were a little early to the game. But at the time, it was definitely looking like it was relevant for custody. And we thought once that was taken up by custody, we'd be ready to jump on top of it from a securities finance perspective. So I think it's interesting to hear from Matt, if he can give us a little overview of where we're at, sort of from a macro perspective, and why should we care about this as securities lenders, I suppose.
Yes, I think 7 years ago probably was a little touch early, I have to say. It's a really good question. And I think when I kind of took over the business in 2020, really kind of early 2020, and you look at the broad landscape of people who are actively involved, it's fair to say there was very few really within that traditional financial world. And what you really need to engage the buy side, the sell side, the FMIs, is regulatory clarity. There's no question about that. You need to have certainty, because if you're going to invest and deploy resources within an organization, you need to know that that's just not going to be wasted. And so I would say, as a function of this market, it is driven a little bit by crypto sentiment, or certainly has been. And so we saw a massive spike in interest 2020, 21, 22. And with that came a lot of interest. And I'd say more traditional financial institutions started to really kind of explore, what does this mean for my securities finance business or my repo business or issuing debt? And so more people invested time and effort. And then the crypto market collapsed, that's been well documented. And then there's probably a pause across most organizations. And at that point in time, we still didn't have really any clarity in the US around the regulations. Europe was starting to move forward positively, and you're starting to see in Asia good positive developments. But what we've really seen at the end of 2024, you know, really driven by, I guess, the change in administration in the US, has been a massive sentiment change. And now you've just really seen that galvanize a market that has been looking to see where they could apply this technology, to now saying, okay, fine, this is something that is a top priority for the US administration. We've seen BlackRock launch its Bitcoin ETF to great success, Fidelity as well, and others. And suddenly you can see how this actually will resonate within the marketplace. And so then if you bring that back to securities finance and repo and intraday, to me, that has become a bit of a topic du jour. Everyone you speak to across the market now recognizes that using this technology for collateral purposes is very, very powerful. And particularly when you have a US president that says, I would like the US to be the crypto capital of the world, that requires a 24/7 marketplace. You've now got a large number of companies thinking about tokenizing a whole variety of different traditional financial assets. Does that mean we are moving to a marketplace that goes beyond the market trading hours? And if that is the case, then you really need to make sure that the infrastructure is there and capable of being able to obviously deliver that. And so I think we've just seen that big change. Now, the one thing, and I know Matt and I have talked about this, you know, is this is a topic that we have been talking about for a long, long time. And it has taken time, a lot longer than I anticipated, to really move the market in a positive way. But I think you've really now started to see just a lot more focus. I mean, 3 years ago, would you have seen Larry Fink, for example, in his letter to shareholders, just talk about tokenization? You've obviously got JP Morgan being very active, you know, on its own digital asset platform for payments, but also thinking it in the context of intraday, which is a microcosm of the financing markets. It just shows how that technology can just make the whole thing more efficient, create more resilience in the market, and reduce risk. And I'm happy to go into more detail on that, because I think that is very applicable for what we're talking about today. So I think we've just seen across the market a big change. And these things do take time. And I look at the progress companies like Broadridge, HQLX, for example, have taken. They've been around for a number of years. But now you're really starting to see, obviously, there's been a lot of positivity around them, but now you're starting to see volumes. There's a real focus on we need to get volumes and show the use cases here.
I think where people like myself tend to get, I don't know about confused, but you have crypto, but you're talking about a much bigger scope in digital assets in general. And it's the technology that was really popularized by crypto trading that now has a lot of other uses that are interesting within our industry.
I think that's right.
Safe to say?
Yeah, it is. And the way I think about it and the way I articulate it in the organization and elsewhere is crypto in itself is just like an asset class. Is it a commodity? Is it security? What is it? But fundamentally, it's a kind of new asset class that people will trade. And you're starting to see institutions like, we can't trade the underlayer, but there's a lot we can trade around it. And so it's an asset class that you'll trade. And so over time, as the market matures, it'll be traded like any other asset class. The underlying technology, and this is to your point, is where you can really start to see transformation in this space. So let's just take it back a step and think really simplistically. And I look at HQLAX. What is HQLAX trying to do as a platform, as a business? They're trying to make the whole collateral for collateral marketplace more efficient. So what they look to do is tokenize real-world financial assets that then can be freely traded on their distributed ledger. And that, if you start to kind of unpick what you can potentially do on the forward, actually creates a lot of opportunity for those looking for finance, but those who can lend. And so I take one simple example. Look at JGB Treasuries. At the moment, if you're looking to trade that market, and that basis trade has existed as long as I can remember, you typically have to provide capital or liquidity because you're crossing two different time zones. If you have that ability to do that transaction without touching or crossing a time zone because the marketplace exists 24/7, suddenly you're freeing up capital that can be deployed more efficiently around the organization. If I'm Matt Brunette and I'm sat there and I'm long liquidity and I say, actually, I've looked at a lot of opportunities and pretty exhausted the normal stuff that we do. Goldman, for example, has a lot of assets that are held, I don't know how much, but they have held domestically. And so they don't naturally kind of fit into traditional financing flows like tri-party flows. If you can get a perfect security interest and tokenize those, you may say, actually, I'm comfortable with X risk, and therefore I will actually increase the potential assets that I will finance against Goldman. So it creates incremental financing opportunities for you.
I think it's interesting when you say, because we start with crypto, and I don't want to anger anybody here. I have a neutral opinion on crypto, but crypto is just crypto, right? It's just a
asset class.
It's a sequence of code.
An underlying technology.
In a digital wallet. But the interesting part, I think, is you take that technology and you start to create digital securities that are based on, I have to watch my words here, but real assets, right? And I want to differentiate it in my brain between crypto, which is its own asset, but it's not based on anything in the real world. You don't have to comment.
I don't have to comment, but you can delineate it very easily.
Yeah, but the technology, I think, is super interesting where you say, okay, let's create a digital representation of something that is an asset that I can take into the real world and I can buy and I can sell and I can exchange for other goods and services. That sounds pretty cool.
I was just going to ask for maybe some examples outside of the buy side, investing in crypto and treating it as an asset class, maybe some of the more traditional institutional buy side pensions or sovereigns. You named a bunch of global asset management firms that are sort of in the crypto space and producing products and probably spending a lot of time in the digital asset world, similar to your bank. But talk to us about globally, some of the large people or institutions that might look like a Norges Bank or some of the North American based pensions or whomever they might be. Where are they likely to start in all of this? If they either aren't there yet or if they already are starting, like what are those trends that are starting to appear?
It's a good question. And it comes back because there is a bit of a blurring. So if I look at kind of just take BlackRock, for example, so they've launched the Bitcoin ETF last year, 2024, and then subsequently an Ethereum kind of an ETH ETF. The Bitcoin ETF, just the market more generally, is probably the most successful ETF launches in history, just given the scale. And the dynamics in the market, and this comes back to what I was trying to say, is that crypto, and crypto could be Bitcoin, it could be ETH, and there are different motivations for why you may invest in a different cryptocurrency, but they are very different to tokenizing financial instruments. I completely agree on that. But this presents an opportunity for certain players in the market to be able to trade them. And the basis trade is a very popular trade that people do. And so what you have seen is a number of, I would say, asset managers and the like actually kind of be very heavily involved in that side of the market. Now, those ETFs need leverage. Some people look for leverage, some people don't. And that's where we've seen certain pockets look to kind of extend credit on ETF products. Not many, but we've started to see that. So that's a very natural opportunity. And you need to think about all the risk parameters, but there's kind of an opportunity there. I think what you have then also started to see is people look to see what is it about this whole collateral space that really will impact the way that we can operate in the marketplace. And you've probably seen more sell side drive this initially. But if I take the intraday repo that sits on blockchain, JP Morgan have been very good at really pushing that out. And that really is very transformative. And I use this as a microcosm of how this technology can impact the market. But if I can tokenize cash, so the JP coin is a good example, it's a digital deposit, reverse that in, I can use that cash on an intraday basis. I can tokenize a treasury or any asset that JP is comfortable, and you use the technology and get settlement finality. So all of a sudden, you transform the intraday repo market, because today it's uncommitted and uncollateralized. So most institutions tend to pre-fund that entire amount. And this is sell side only, but just giving you the full picture here. And so all of a sudden, you change the risk dynamic. So suddenly it's not idiosyncratic to the borrower. And so as you can see, as the market starts to develop and broaden and more people are there to lend because they've got the confidence of the asset that's been collateralized, suddenly you're in the intraday market, you're borrowing funds from the minute that you need them to the minute that you no longer need them. So then you reverse that transaction. And then you can just be more efficient in terms of the costs and your use of liquidity. We've seen a lot of buy side say, look, this is actually really interesting because a lot of funds, for example, are long liquidity, particularly on an intraday basis. That ability over time, as this market does properly develop into something that is more utility-esque, that becomes an opportunity for those buy side institutions to generate more yield on cash that would otherwise sit idle. There are other ways to do this by tokenized money market funds and things like that, but I'll just keep it simple for now. And so you can see how that can also develop into intraday FX as well. We're very focused on that as an institution. So that's one good example.
So do you think we start to create an intraday money market?
Well, the way I would see it is you'd probably use stable coins. But who benefits from stablecoins? If we just look at Circle, which is one that's quite preeminent in the market at the moment, USDC, they mint coins, which are representative of dollars. They use the cash they receive, fiat, and they invest in treasuries and put some element of that cash on deposit. And then that can be used on an intraday basis. And then if you want to earn liquidity, because stablecoins are non-interest bearing, you can, if you would like to stay in the digital asset ecosystem, move to money market fund tokens. BlackRock has one, Franklin has one, and many others are developing them. For what it's worth, bit of a pitch, we're about, through our platform, about to see a number of money market funds tokenized for institutional purposes. So really that collateral use case, and we're working with many across the market.
I have a couple of questions about the ecosystem. So you're saying that you can drastically reduce your intraday counterparty risk or your intraday funding risk. And you can take assets to, you mentioned JP Morgan, within their scope of their universe, which I don't know what that is, but US Treasuries, you mentioned, and you can have that created into a coin. But does that introduce other counterparty risk? So the issuer of the coin?
Well, I think just if you take that very simply, so we on just say we on an intraday basis borrow money from JP, that happens already. But we do that uncollateralized, uncommitted on a daily basis. So naturally, we prudently pre-fund all of that, because if there was something idiosyncratic that was, you know, happened to GS, or, and this could be relevant for anyone, then at least you know you've got the confidence that funding is there. And that's something that the regulations naturally stipulate. If you can transform the way that transaction works, so JP Morgan said, look, we have a digital dollar on chain, so on their own private network, which is a distributed ledger, and you have the ability to tokenize the financial asset. So I'm just using treasuries as an example. Then what you can do is you can replicate that same transaction on chain, but you do it in a collateralized way. And because of the precision of the technology, you just do that to the minute that you need it, to the minute you don't need it. And so that is very, very powerful, because that transforms that, because the idiosyncratic risk there is slightly muted because you're collateralized with a haircut. So it's no different to any securities finance transaction or anything like that. So it's the same way you apply haircuts to assets. So you're just removing that bit of risk. In today's world, it's just very difficult to be able to have that settlement finality confidence, hence why they're uncollateralized.
Understood. And that US Treasury sits in a custody account and it's wrapped in an ISLA document that perfects a security interest, or how does that part of it work?
We actually did it, I think it was under an MRA, but yes, what happens is, and this is the same for HQLX, and I'm sure for Broadridge and the others, that when you tokenize an existing financial instrument, it then sits effectively kind of in an escrow and is kind of immobilized. And so the token is then that representation of that asset. I won't go into native tokens and things like that because I think that'll confuse things, but that's fundamentally how it works. Another area which I think is really, really interesting is, and this is kind of comes back to your question in around money market fund tokens. So if you're looking to use those for collateral purposes, you can allocate an instrument that has a T+0 pricing. And as this technology is evolving, you're starting to see oracles now. So the ability to actually transpose financial pricing onto assets on chain with T+0 pricing doesn't need to be real time. Actually just has that T+0. Because if we look at a lot of traditional collateralizations, they tend to have T+1, T+2 pricing. So it removes a lot of that jump risk. And so these are the small kind of little things that actually really enhance the way the market operates for all of those involved.
So Matthew, one question that has been brought up in different industry association gatherings is, and you've referenced it a few different times, but is the shift to 24-hour trading. And I appreciate it. This is all interconnected, and that maybe is being driven for broader purposes, but yet is potentially facilitated by much of this type of technology that we're talking about. But how do you see, because if you remove the conversation around digital assets and blockchain and all of the sort of technology use cases that you're referring to, when people think about 24-hour trading for securities lending or securities finance related transaction, that starts to get very complicated quickly because there's settlement timeframes, there's selling of positions, and there's recalling of those positions on loans. There's collateralization and when you mark things, and the concept of collateralization happens at one point in the day currently on the price that is known and struck at one point in the day. But the concept of 24-hour trading, the cycle is ongoing. So I'm just curious, because I'm sure it's a podcast all on its own. How do you see this all tied together? And do you see the conversation on 24-hour trading happening now because of all of these emerging technologies and the ability to actually support the flow?
It is a good question. And I think if you actually look what's really driving it, so the crypto markets have been 24/7 since their inception. You look at the success of the ETF market. What I find is a really good way to describe this. The Bitcoin ETF trades 5 days a week, as we know, but yet the underlying risk is 24/7. So there is kind of asymmetry there naturally. So if you've got a levered position going into a weekend, there could be quite a lot of volatility over that weekend that you need to really think through very carefully. And if you've got bank holidays and things. And so as we move and embrace the underlying technology and you start to see more people across the market trade crypto, then naturally they're going to have to trade 24/7. And then you start to think about, well, what is it within the financial marketplace? What's driving that? And so this ability to use collateral 24/7 becomes pretty powerful, because then to your point, yes, you need time cutoffs and things like that, but you can quite easily have a governance framework around that, that it's 5 p.m. Eastern or whatever, to actually be the reference point each day. But what it does allow you to do is move collateral. So you can collateralize these trades. So if Matt's kind of lending X amount on equities and the equities move quite materially, you can be just very, very efficient with your collateralization of those transactions. So I think this is kind of where you see it progressing. But I don't think we're too close to that yet, just to be brutally honest. I think what this marketplace needs is a better understanding of the commercial drivers as to why you would look to use distributed ledger technology for securities finance, for repo intraday more broadly. You know, there's people like me who live and breathe it who can really see that commercial value, but that needs to be articulated more widely. We can see how digital money can also have a profound impact. And I think probably the acceleration of the use of stablecoin over the next 6 to 12 months, I think will highlight a lot of the benefits there. And people will just recognize this is just a more efficient way for us to transact.
Maybe we can have you do another session when you feel like it's a little closer. It sounds like your comment was you think 24-hour trading is still quite a ways off.
I think it's an inevitability, but I do think, you know, just given the way the US is really keen to go, but I think for all different markets, it's not going to happen overnight.
I think you could do a whole nother rabbit hole podcast on the arguments around 24/7 trading. It wasn't that long ago when I was an equity trader that there were serious suggestions around having just a single point of trade in a day. You basically just have a clearing auction once a day for your buyers and sellers. And there's reasons over time why the market has to kind of take a pause now and then due to volatility interruptions, et cetera. And then you had what I thought was, I saw a really interesting interview with Sam Bankman-Fried years ago talking about instantaneous margining. But then you think that through and you say that could be also catastrophic. It's very cool, but it could be sort of self-fulfilling as well. But we want to talk a little bit about going back to the previous short discussion is, I think where I got a little lost and where I think people like me needed some comfort was around the security interest and how that works. And Isla, I know, is doing some work on that. And is that the end goal, to provide a document that clarifies your security interest in this asset in your example that's held in an escrow account in JP Morgan, that at the time of your counterparty's unfortunate default, that you have the token?
Yeah, the token is has a perfect
gone.
Security.
Yeah,
exactly.
And there's an asset there at the end of the day.
Yeah, I mean, think of securitization. Think of anything like that. You have a perfected security interest on an underlying asset. And so let's use HQLAX, good example. So you're starting, you know, to see more and more transactional activity on that platform. The way that that works is they have a trusted third party, which at present is Clearstream. And so what they do is they validate the security interest of the token on the underlying asset or pool of assets. So you have someone who acts as the validator. Now, what is Isla doing? Isla's really been very front-footed, I think, in this space. And I think there's two kind of key areas. One is thinking around the legal documentation and what does it mean to actually think about transacting with digital tokens and crypto for that matter. So, you know, there's a lot of work that's ongoing there. And then the second area is something called the common domain model. And so once you start to introduce more technology into these markets, standardization is absolutely paramount. And so you see that also with ISDA, ICMA as well, also focused on common domain models. And it's really getting that standardization. So there's something called smart contracts that basically are self-executing programs that automate actions on the distributed ledgers. And the more standardized the process can be, the better, naturally. And so really the common domain model will become ever more, I think, prevalent as this market really does start to build out. So they're the two key areas that the association has been very focused on.
I think that's a great point around standardization, because I think where what's been a huge success is confidence in the transfer of title model when it comes to collateral management, right? That's been tested with Lehman Brothers. It's been tested by other people that have a bigger counterparty list than I do since Lehman Brothers, and it works. So I think if the industry can get people like me confident in that through digital assets, I think there's massive potential for that, because I agree with you, absolutely. There's huge room for improvement in the technology and the efficiencies around bringing things to real settlement in real time has benefits across pretty much all the products we trade in just custody, non-securities finance transactions as well, of course. And to your point on standardization, that if we don't as an industry create standardization, which I believe enables scale, then everyone just starts doing that in a bespoke way anyways. And isn't it better if everyone's playing by the same rule set, and it makes it so much easier to add on the next counterparty and the next asset class?
And just one other last little example to give you that we're working on, and I'll keep the names nameless, but we have certain treasury assets and other assets that occasionally can sit unencumbered because they've missed the market cutoffs. That ability to tokenize and then mobilize and then put into the natural funding flows, again, just creates more efficiency. And so while this might not all happen tomorrow, next week, next month, you can see the pathway, which is why I've always been very excited about the potential. Going back to your point, standardization, absolutely key.
Yeah, it essentially allows you to open up liquidity, use unused assets more effectively, be more efficient.
Yeah, when we looked at this way three and a half years ago, you know, you look at a lot of assets, it goes back to the kind of domestically held or just unencumbered, which I guess is a more commonly used expression, but assets that just sit there unencumbered and that ability to really free them up and encumber them. And in a world where you've got neobanks, where one could argue deposits perhaps don't have that same modeled maturity in terms of their funding capacity that they once did, just because people can double click and take it straight out. And banks, for example, can only issue so much unsecured debt. That ability to just be more proficient with your assets on balance sheet, I think, is very powerful.
That's great. Well, this has been super interesting. Matthew, thank you for joining us and being willing to chat through this. I think the GPFA community and those attending ISLA will really appreciate the primer. It likely means that there will hopefully be a lot more engagement on these types of topics at the conference upcoming and ongoing through other continued industry forums and such in the year or more to come. But I think doing a check-in at some point in the future on this would be great too. This is a rapidly changing space we appreciate. And so it's great that you're at the forefront of it. So thank you.
My pleasure. And thank you for having me.
Yeah, definitely. And we look forward to seeing many of our listeners that will be attending the Madrid conference. I assume both Matt and Matthew, you'll be there in person. Is that a fair assumption to make?
That's correct.
Yes.
Good, good. Okay. Well, I always threaten to do things in person. So if anything, we'll look forward to chatting in person. But if anyone at the conference wants to podcast more with GPFA, let us know in advance and maybe we can look to continue some of these educational opportunities ongoing. Thanks again, Matt. Thank you, Matthew. And thank you to our listeners.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Peer Connections by GPFA. We hope you found the information shared in this podcast interesting and beneficial. And as always, please feel free to reach out to GPFA with ideas or interests for future episodes. And if you liked what you heard today, don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Now for the disclaimer. The opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the presenters and do not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of their respective employer organizations. This material is for your private information and does not constitute legal, tax, or investment advice. There's no representation or warranty as to the current accuracy of nor liability for decisions based on this information.